My question has to do with when I noticed internalized depression that has shut me down, which typically I notice that later. And if it's a repeating context, bringing it back up, and that I tend to bring it up with extra energy around it.
So can we generalize from it to a larger topic of how do we deal with our internalized oppression when we're leading?
Yes.
So I first of all want to define what I mean by internalized oppression, why this topic is of such great interest to me, and I started putting it at the center of things, doing more work in it more explicitly. And I'm now getting on an on-ramp of excitement. So the whole topic of internalized oppression begins from the depressing insight that it's rarely the case that a system can be so powerful that it can enforce itself on the rest of the people without people in one form or another giving their consent. There isn't enough physical force around to keep everyone in submission if we don't, to some extent, agree to go along. And there's the image that I don't know if it's true or not, but it is powerful, so I will share it, that when an elephant is captured, they tie the elephant with a lot of chains so it wouldn't be able to run away. Gradually, over time, they remove more and more of the chains. Eventually, there's a little rope that is tied to the elephant's toe, which the elephant would have complete and total physical capacity to yank away and run away, and the elephant doesn't. Because by then, the elephant's will has been subdued and contained, and the rope symbolizes unfreedom at that point. So we are all like that elephant. And so internalized depression is the process by which we organize our internal life in relationship to narratives that are being said about who we are, especially narratives as they apply to a group that we are part of, not just individually. So when I say organize my internal structure around narratives, it doesn't necessarily mean agree with them, but they are the focal point. I either agree with them or I reject them or I am defiant against them, but I am in relationship with those narratives rather than living my life from within my center of who I am. And what I want to do, and what my purposes are, and what my values are, and what my relationships are, and what matters to me, and all of those things. That's a free life. If I am constantly in relationship with narratives, I do not live a free life. I'm wondering if everybody recognizes how much of your life is based in that way. I can remember before discovering feminism that the big part of my life was organized around rejecting all the women that I believed were bringing sexism on themselves because of how they were behaving in the world. And I was damned if I was going to be like those women. That is internalized sexism 101 in a complicated way. I didn't have any idea that I was running a narrative. I thought I was so cool and free. And I even had contempt for women. Until it became clear to me that me and all other women are subjected to a system that controls what is or isn't possible for us. And the amount of extraordinary work that it takes to liberate ourselves from those narratives enough to come to a place of tenderness and compassion. The contempt that I had for women kept me from agreeing to play certain roles. I never, ever in my life played the feminine roles, just never. But that doesn't mean I was free, because I was reactive. So that's kind of like the most general thing that I can say about internalized oppression. And actually, I have one more thing to say in general, and then I'm going to check in about where specifically you see it. But one other thing is that we often manage our internalized oppression through taking on the role of the victim. The role of the victim can look like having very, very complex, rich, and accurate social analysis about the systems that oppress people like me. And still, if that is all I see, and I blame the people or the systems that are keeping me oppressed, without seeing that no matter how oppressed I am, I have a sphere of freedom within myself. If I don't see that, then I am fully within internalized oppression, even when I have a very, very rich and accurate social analysis. I'm taking a breath because it's one of those moments where I feel like I gave voice to something of such critical importance, and it was clear and concise. And the grief and horror that are packed into all that I said don't have voice. So my body carries tension from the intensity of naming things without weeping and wailing while I do it. So I want to take a moment to just allow all of us to digest the horror that I'm pointing to. So I'd like to hear from you the specific situations, and I'm also realizing there's like a whole other layer of why do we even internalize? How does it happen? What is the mechanism? That goes back to those triangles that I will activate, but I want to put that on pause and engage with you first.
I think I'm relating a lot to what you just said. So the situation was in a meeting, I made a proposal and got a quick negative reaction from someone who does not gender identify as male, but presents enough as male, that in that moment, I think I was responding to the maleness and the structural authority. And I just kind of like sucked my proposal back and stopped speaking about it. I mean, we also later unpacked it and recognized some decision-making process gaps. But then when I came back to bring it up and to even make note of my internalized oppression, I found myself in this more, so the words I want to use are strident and shrill in my like wanting the attention and wanting the acknowledgement. So there was some way that I was still in it instead of just sort of calmly stepping back and going, okay, that happened. I did that. This issue is still important to me. And now I want to bring it back up with freedom, but I didn't have the freedom. I was still in the wrestling with the internalized oppression. And
okay. Is there anyone here, especially all those who've been in female bodies, the majority or whole of your life, that doesn't recognize the piece that Leslie's talking about? Yeah, it's crushingly familiar. Both sides of it, I think, are familiar. So I want to first see if we can catch the thought that was going on in your mind in the moment when you gave up on your proposal.
So the thought in my mind, it was something like, he's more important than me, even though he's not the gender pronoun I would try to use for this person. But like, he's more important to me. He knows better.
Did you actually think that? Or do you recognize after the fact that that was what was going on?
Yeah, I think it's after the fact. Like, it was one of those things that was there, but it wasn't verbalized in my mind.
So here's my question to you. You put out a proposal and halfway through you stop. You have a thought. You actually have a thought mm-hmm. that is leading you to stop. Can you catch what that thought was? Because you are too smart to have the thought be, he's more important. If you had that thought, you would go, wait a minute, I don't believe in that. You would catch it. So it has to be more pernicious. But I can't know what it is for you.
I almost think it's something like I've stepped too far. I'm asking too much.
Okay. Do you see the difference between that and the he's more important, which is more analytical? It doesn't have vibrancy. This one does.
Yeah, I can feel the emotion.
Yes. There's no accident that Robin Morgan wrote a book called Going Too Far. There is no way we will liberate ourselves without going too far. Now, let me give you something that is literal and material that I don't have the reference for. It's many years ago that I came across it. When you observe parents of toddlers in playground, when you measure the distance that the parents let their son toddler go before they will call them back, and their girl toddlers go before they will call them back, they call their girl toddlers at a shorter distance from the parent. Come back! Then they call the son. So in the literal physical body sense, the little boy has more distance to go before being reined in. So I just want you and all of us, both those of us who were boys and those of us who were girls, whatever gender we are taking on, we were raised generally as boys or girls. Those of us who were raised as boys and those of us who were raised as girls, I want all of us to take this in because it's monumentally tragic. You feel it, don't you?
Yeah.
Speak to the emotion.
I have a little bit of an image of like a rope and then you're like pulled back.
Yes.
And one is, it's like the arbitrariness of it.
Yeah.
And that then it doesn't feel arbitrary. It's almost like we have to like make up some reason. And so then that's part of how the oppression gets in because, there must be something wrong or different or less of me.
Yeah. So this is a moment in which I can give an example. You could now go to therapy and receive support, and maybe you do go to therapy, and maybe you will do this, receive support to heal this trauma. That will take X months, X years. Or you can make an agreement with yourself, which is not going to be an easy agreement. And the agreement with yourself is that when you have this feeling of going too far, you will continue for one whole minute before you let yourself pull back. And if one whole minute is too long, you will continue for 5 seconds. You will just literally push your body to go further before accepting the yank of the rope. And you can choose what that will be for you. Or it can be, I will say one more thing before I stop speaking, or whatever it is, but something concrete that goes against the training, against what you have internalized, even when you don't feel up to it or ready for it. This is the path of practical growth.
That's helpful. And it's helpful to have stepped back and identified that moment more clearly.
Yes.
So that now I can recognize it. And there is a little bit of a physical, like there's some sort of withdrawal that I do. And I think if I can be aware of that physical withdrawal, then I could be like, okay, girl, you got to keep talking.
Yeah.
And I probably won't die. So then I'll probably do it again.
Yeah. So let's do the second part, which is what was going on that led you to be strident, shrill, whatever. And even before that, part of the training for women, for girls, especially white middle-class girls, which I think is the category that you were raised into, is that assertiveness is frowned upon, isn't it?
Yes, it's interesting. I feel like I was not raised that way in my family of origin, but in the rest of the culture, yes.
Because it's not so for all groups of women. I think becoming intimate with our internalized oppression is a path of liberation. So I am wondering if you can imagine listening to yourself completely from the outside, completely from the outside. Would you actually sound strident and shrill? So another part of the practice for you then is to continue to speak even when you believe that you're strident and shrill.
That one's not quite as hard for me. I think I do speak then, but then I guess there's this later. Okay. I feel this internal push.
Yes. Here's what I'm thinking is going on. You need to bring in something to overcompensate for the yank. And that something creates power that isn't grounded in your wholeness. That is what sounds to you as strident and shrill.
Yes. It's that piece that you were saying before, that instead of withdrawing because of the internalized oppression, I'm rebelling against it. I'm still in relation to it.
Exactly. And this one is harder to overcome than the other one for two reasons. One is it actually has positive survival value. When we're able to rebel against the oppression, to defy the oppression, we actually create more options for ourselves. And it's like, why would I give this up? Don't want to. That's one. The other reason why it's difficult to get rid of that one is that the antidoting of it is vulnerability. And it's not going to be the easiest thing on the planet when you are already challenged, when you are already unsure that it's okay for you to speak, when you're unsure how you will be received, when you know you're going against your training, when you need to mobilize all this force to suddenly go vulnerable. And still, to whatever extent, we can take those breaths and say, it doesn't have to be dramatic. You don't have to sit there and weep and wail. Just to take a few breaths and say, I have something to say, and there's a tremendous amount of struggle inside of me about saying it because of my internalized sexism. And I am not even sure if it will sound right or not, but I'm saying what I'm saying now because I want to be more integrated while I speak, period. And then continue. You will need less of that. You feel it?
Yeah, I do. So I did something like that, actually. I think I named my own sort of surprise at recognizing the internal oppression, but I didn't name...
Okay, you named it in the past.
Right, I didn't name it in this moment. That's the difference.
It is orders of magnitude less vulnerable to speak about an insight that I have about something that happened in the past than to speak about what is going on inside of me in the moment.
I mean, I can feel like the battle inside me of the, don't do that, you got to push.
And just name it, that's going on. And to even say, I'm not going to solve it right now. And I don't want my not solving it to prevent me from speaking, but I'm hoping that I will be more integrated if I tell you that I'm speaking through a battlefield that you can't even see unless I tell you.
Yes, thank you. I feel very complete and grateful for the richness that keeps coming out of these two moments.
Yes. Okay. I want to just say a couple of things about how we come to agree to this. The mechanisms of socialization are particularly virulent when it comes to messages about someone from the group that we are. Just a few days ago, I did a piece of work on internalized oppression, and I worked with a man who had a memory of being four, and he has a name that could also be a girl's name. Let's say that the name is Pat. And somebody was saying, you have a girl's name. And in his memory, when he was four, he already knew that being like a girl was the thing most to be avoided. He already knew that and fought his whole life not to be like a girl. And the piece of work that I did with him, which was very powerful, was to ask him to name all the ways in which he's like a girl. And he half squeezed himself out of that by changing the words being like a girl to my feminine side. And I told him, that's too easy, like a girl. And it was really, really, really hard work for him. And it was very clear, this is precisely internalized oppression. There isn't a whole lot that is being said or spoken about in terms of the internalized oppression of those who are raised to be in positions of privilege. But it's absolutely to be clear and understood that no one would agree to be in a position of privilege and therefore to meet their needs at the expense of others if they didn't first suffer major tears within who they are. And there is one oppression that every single one of us has experienced, and that is the oppression of being a child. The whole society is set up for children to be, I mean, children still, even once official slavery is gone, I mean, of course, slavery continues in the world, but official slavery is gone. And still, the only category of people that officially are property are children. Children are still property. It is understood and assumed that children are told what to do. It is understood and assumed that adults know better than children what works for the child. I mean, there's like a whole long list of horrifically oppressive attitudes and practices towards children that every single one of us suffered. All of us have experienced it. So all of us carry internalized oppression from having been children. It often will show up as we will avoid being ridiculous. We'll avoid standing out in certain ways. We will avoid doing things that people don't like in general. There's like a whole slew of things that comes with what we're told to do or not do as children. Now, the mechanism of internalized oppression is fundamentally the mechanism of shaming. We accept our roles within an oppressive system, whether it's the role of oppressor or the role of oppressed. Initially, it doesn't matter. Initially, we have to accept the role, because if we don't accept it, we will be shunned. We will not receive belonging. And extremely few of us are willing to risk not belonging in order to maintain the truth of who we are. Extremely few of us. And so we accept and modify ourselves, stretch ourselves, put squares into a round peg, do any number of pretzels to fit what is being said about who we are, so that we can get the modicum of belonging that comes from agreeing to it. So even if we are oppressed, exploited, or whatever, we will be better treated if we accept the role of being an exploited worker than if we don't. We will be better treated if we accept the subjugated roles of women, of a person of color, or whatever. We will be treated better if we accept that role than if we don't. And similarly, we will be treated better if we are oppressive when we are men or white people or whatever, then we will be if we stand up to the oppression as the people in the position of privilege. So there is like this huge pressure that we internalize because of our need for belonging. That is what I wanted to say in terms of mechanism.